It is time for the Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage for Robinhood Radio and exclusive to Robinhood Radio. David is a multimedia and international journalist with his own online column at themediabeat.us. And as a special correspondent since 2012, he has contributed TV reports to the PBS network, mostly on ethical issues. Here's David.
This is David Tereshchuk with the Media Beat for the weekend beginning December 15th, 2023. This will be the last week for now that I report from Ireland. It was a week, too, that I spent partly in the UK. Hopping over the Irish Sea was a good media-watching move because, on the English side, the political news pot was bubbling on the stove almost to boiling point. Britain's Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, the third person in that office in just 14 months, was, according to a lot of very excitable Fleet Street commentators, confronting his toughest challenges yet. According to some of those analysts, the week was making the PM, quote, wonder if he should ever have run for leader of the Tory party and thus for prime minister. That was from the BBC. And according to the ever-hysterical London Evening Standard newspaper, he faced, quote, the most perilous week of his premiership, with his fate lying in the hands of warring party factions. But first things first, even before facing the wrath of his own Conservative Party, the Tories, he was called to be cross-examined by the official inquiry into the government's handling of the COVID pandemic. During that crisis, Sunak had held another high office in the cabinet, Chancellor of the Exchequer, that still surviving medieval title that equates to finance minister in other countries, Treasury Secretary in the US. And he attracted criticism for beating the economic drum too much then, possibly at the risk of endangering citizens' lives by urging the early opening up of businesses, especially in Britain's vital hospitality industry, at a time when many experts wanted the national COVID lockdown to continue. Most emblematic of Sunak's approach was the campaign he headed with the slogan, Eat Out to Help Out. It would help out the economy, was the idea. But many medical authorities doubted the wisdom of encouraging people to socialize again as soon as Sunak wanted them to. They found it irresponsible, indeed. One of the extraordinary off-the-cuff bits of evidence that has emerged in the course of this inquiry has been that the government's chief scientific advisor, Professor Angela McLean, pinned on Sunak the unforgettable label Dr. Death in a WhatsApp messaging exchange she typed out with a fellow government advisor. At the inquiry early this week, as soon as Sunak took his oath to tell the truth before the presiding judge, he said, I just wanted to start by saying how deeply sorry I am to all of those who lost loved ones, family members, through the pandemic, and also all those who suffered in various ways throughout the pandemic and as a result of the actions that were taken. But he went on to defend himself robustly, protesting that he had not heard any health concerns being raised before he introduced the Eat Out program by those people who now say it was too risky. After the Prime Minister's inquiry appearance came those internal political party threats. They all concerned his determined effort to press ahead with a government plan that many around the world must find utterly outlandish. The plan is to discourage asylum seekers coming to Britain, many of whom drown in frail boats sailing across the English Channel, by flying survivors to be processed, as the phrase goes, in the East Central African country of Rwanda. This in spite of the UK's Supreme Court issuing its judgment last month that the plan is unlawful. It's unlawful, the court said, because asylum seekers would be flown to a country that is not safe for them. A moderate division of Tory members of Parliament, I suppose that's an appropriate label for them, it's the label favoured by the British press anyway, these members have respectfully followed the court's line and said the unlawful plan should be dropped. By contrast, the right wing of the party, a large wing that comprises five different streams of MPs, threatened to destroy the plan by voting it down in Parliament. They argued that it doesn't go far enough. It's already been changed on Sunak's orders in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision. His new measures, technically described as emergency legislation, take a whole new tack. They declare that, by law, Rwanda is a safe country. One eminent legal authority told journalists very pointedly that this is, and I quote, like saying that, by law, all dogs are now, in fact, cats. The whole fatuous argument, even if you restrict your view merely to the quarrelling inside the Tory party, is a sorry testimony to how British politics have degenerated in recent times. The legislation was even named Safety of Rwanda Bill, a provocatively doubtful claim at best. Sunak himself called it the toughest immigration law ever, and the headline writers were saying the struggle over it will likely derail Sunak's government. In the event, this week's vote, by no means the last one in the process of enacting it into law, was won by Sunak and his government whips in Parliament, who did a lot of cracking the whip. So was it all a storm in a teacup, stirred up by melodramatic media? I don't think so. There is a very real set of cracks and fissures at work in this situation, and the UK press is naturally full of it. Very few of Britain's mass media outlets are actual opposition supporters, supporters of the Labour Party, that is. But one of them, the venerable, or at least very long-lasting, Daily Mirror, was being clinical more than just ordinarily partisan when it labelled Sunak a dead man walking after his victory. It pointed out that overall the, quote, hideously expensive, unworkable and immoral Rwanda gimmick is the sign of a government rapidly disintegrating before our very eyes. And to quote more of the Mirror's choice phrasing, the paper foresaw, quote, a Tory revolt against the PM continuing now over months of bloody battles with the right-wingers making his life hell. There is objective evidence for the dead man walking notion. Whether Sunak keeps his right wing at bay or he doesn't, he will have to face the entire British public very soon in a general election. The latest polls show just how fed up that public is with 13 years now of Tory government. The numbers are pretty clear. 45% of British adults say they'd vote for the Labour Party. That perhaps does not sound resounding, but it's more than twice as many as would vote for Sunak's Conservatives. They are languishing at only 22%. The remaining third of the electorate will likely go to the smaller Liberal Democratic Party, as well as parties from the disparate, barely united parts of the supposedly United Kingdom, Scotland, Wales, and the inwardly divided case of Northern Ireland. Sunak's days look decidedly numbered. It's very hard to imagine him being returned to office next year. I have not seen, but would appreciate seeing, any journalism of substance that might pull together the three different strands of immigration politics, which have been all playing out almost simultaneously. Besides Sunak's trouble in the UK, President Emmanuel Macron in France has been trying to get a painstakingly prepared immigration bill through the National Assembly, a bill which, among other things, would strike a balance by, on the one hand, deporting immigrants who commit crimes, while at the same time legalizing undocumented workers, or at least some of them. But this week, Macron's bill was roundly and, to his own great shock, defeated in the Assembly. He just couldn't round up the votes to support him. And his humiliating loss prompted, among others, the prominent political analyst Chloe Morin to conclude in her words, "We are now entering the end of Emmanuel Macron's reign." And meanwhile, across the Atlantic, another president, Joe Biden, was struggling to get reluctant Republicans in Congress to pass his extended funding for Ukraine in its defensive war against Russia. In fact, Senate Republicans successfully blocked what Biden sees as his essential $110.5 billion emergency foreign aid measure for Ukraine, Israel, and other global hotspots. To allow all this aid through, the Republicans are demanding in return, guess what? Tighter immigration measures. Those demands now include a massive expansion of detention centers and, how about this, a scheme to send asylum seekers to other countries which the US deems to be safe. Sounds quite a bit like Britain hoping to send theirs to Rwanda, doesn't it? My London trip from Ireland also involved, besides UK politics, seeing an Irish play. But calling it such isn't really enough. The complexities of its Irishness require a lot more attention. It's called Ulster American, and it's playing at the Riverside Studios in London's Hammersmith district. Those studios are a legendary kind of venue, not just because it has staged brave new drama ever since the 1970s, but it was also before that a BBC location when its studio floors were graced by the earliest episodes of Doctor Who and many other well-loved drama and music programmes. In the current entertainment, Ulster American, there is in fact an Ulster American character, kind of. There's a play within the play. It's a play about a play, or at least it's prompted by a play. A script is being discussed by the creative team involved prior to rehearsal, and the main character in the inner play is a loyalist paramilitary murderer. Loyalist in the sense of being loyal to Britain, unionist in that he wants the union of Northern Ireland with Britain to continue. The trouble is, the murderer is to be played by an Oscar-winning Irish-American movie star, cunningly lampooned here by Woody Harrelson. Like far too many Irish-Americans, in fact or fiction, I'm afraid, the not-very-bright star that he plays has not the slightest understanding of what the Northern Irish Troubles were actually about, or the significance of their difficult legacies now. The character has other faults too, and Harrelson has a lot of fun with them, but his ignorance is also used skillfully by the Belfast-born playwright David Ireland to explore all manner of sad, though sometimes ridiculously comic, human self-deceptions. These range across politics, national and sexual, the world of theatre itself, the weird power of Hollywood celebrity, and the imminent menace of sudden bloody violence. The show can get quite meta, since the two other characters on stage are the inner play's director, performed by an excruciatingly ingratiating Andy Serkis, and its author, played by not David Ireland himself, but of course by an actor, Louisa Harland, famous for her role in television's Derry Girls, and she registers a fierce determination to protect her own dramatic creation. If you're in London or can get there, I enthusiastically suggest you see Ulster American, which plays until the end of January 2024. That's all from the Media Beat this week. If you have been, thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.us.